Hello, I'm Keith Parent, and welcome to Focus Asia Pacific. Coming up on today's programs, floods across Australia and Jakarta, and the United Nations is closer to setting up a commission inquiry into North Korean crimes against humanity. We have this and much more on this edition of Focus Asia Pacific, putting the focus on the Asia Pacific. The flood emergency across Australia appears to be over for most of Queensland and New South Wales. While the town of Gafton in New South Wales experiencing near-record flood, its levee held, but only just. Hundreds of homes and rural properties remain flooded, and communities cut off by road and rail are making it difficult to resupply stores and supermarkets. In Queensland, it was not the most comfortable evening for about 1,000 Brandenburg residents who spent the night in emergency accommodation after floodwaters forced them to evacuate their homes. At least they were safe as Brandenburg suffered its worst ever flood recorded. Areas along the northern side of the Burnett River have been worse affected. We have this story from Martin Cuddy.
On the southern outskirts of Brandenburg, a shed is home to more than 200 people. Inside is row after row of inflatable mattresses, interspersed with the occasional porta-cot. Industrial fans try to keep the humidity at bay, while outside towels dry on a makeshift clothesline.
Since we came to the evacuation centre today, everyone has been more than helpful and just going out of their way to do anything they can to help people adjust.
Chantel Dunbar sits on a mattress next to her two boys. Across the river, her home is underwater, and she's thinking about what she would have saved if there'd been more time.
All the photos, all the memories, years of kindergarten pictures, kindergarten drawings, kindergarten photos. Gosh, what's replaceable, what's not?
What's the one thing that you keep thinking about?
How to start again. How long does it take to pick yourself back up and start again?
At the evacuation centre, volunteers from charities are helping where they can. Some people are sleeping in their only clothes. Others sit in plastic chairs staring into the distance. About eight older people who've had to flee the rising waters are still on the beds from their aged care facility. Yvonne Hill has spent a second night in emergency accommodation. The home she shares with her grandchildren is close to the water. She's expecting the worst.
I think it got washed away. We really got flooded, hit by the floods. We had three cars too in the family, and they're all gone down the river.
So what runs through your mind on a night like tonight when the river is peaking?
It's just hard to believe that this happened. The other day we had blue skies and sun was out, everything, and then all of a sudden flood came up. Devastating flood.
Have you ever seen a flood come up as quickly as this one?
No, I haven't, no. And the sad part of it was that we only had probably half an hour to go to get things organised. Yeah, so I think, you know, probably a bit more notice would have been good, even though they might not have known, I don't know.
If you only had half an hour, how can you prioritise what to get out of the house?
We've sort of got a living area underneath too, so everything from underneath came up, but the water was probably waist deep by that time when we were trying to get everything up. Yeah, so it was really hard to decide what we could take up. All the, you know, like washing machines, all the white goods sort of still floating around downstairs there.
Did you think about photos or family memories?
No, they were all upstairs mainly. Yeah.
And do you think they're still there?
No. Even the school kids' clothes, their books, we've spent hundreds of dollars on, have probably gone out to sea now.
Now we move to Indonesia. Floods have become a way of life for people in the capital, Jakarta, with their city regularly being swamped by torrential rain. But this month's deluge was worse than most, and 30 people lost their lives. It has exposed once again just how unprepared Indonesia's capital is to deal with natural disaster. Helen Brown has more.
Like many Jakartans, Marco Kusuma Wijaya has a long clean-up ahead. His street was flooded by a torrent of water that came through when a major canal nearby broke its banks. His wife managed to save important family documents, but not much else as the floodwaters came in.
All the furnitures moved around. Our freezer fell off. And now the mud got into our cupboard and my books are wet. All my shoes are destroyed.
But Marco Kusuma Wijaya isn't just any resident cleaning up a muddy mess. He's also an urban planner and sustainable development activist. And he says there were signs well before that the canal's levee bank was weak and that authorities have failed to do the proper checks.
You know, for some time last year, I already saw some water seeping out on that side, on the street side. And that makes me think that it might be some sign of this collapse.
Questions are also being asked about why huge billboards were allowed to be built into the foundations of the flood, or what Indonesians call Banjir Canal. Dr. Muhammad Hussain is the Director General of Water Resources at the Public Works Ministry. His department doesn't issue permits for billboards, but is responsible for the canal.
We realized that the maintenance, not only for this Banjir Canal system, but also for all infrastructures, is mostly, I think, it's not very, we have to improve it, yes, in general. There's still some room for improvement, I think.
Jakarta's clogged rivers, inadequate drains and poor city planning have been the bane of residents who've long called for a change. The latest flood isn't as big as one in 2007, but for the millions of people who live here, it shows how little local and central governments have done since then to prevent another disaster.
I feel that there are more and more people getting fed up with this, and I think you can see from media, from social media, from talk, there are more people concerned.
At the flood's height, more than 45,000 people were displaced from their homes. 32 died. That's bad enough. But there's a huge economic cost as well. Business groups say the floods have put Jakarta's growth and reputation at risk. The canal was taking water beyond its capacity. And when the levee bank broke, the water coursed down through Jakarta's streets, turning major roads into brown, murky rivers and pushing flood waters right up to some of its most prestigious real estate. The main thoroughfare for business and government became a chaotic mess. The Jakarta Chamber of Commerce and Industry says the government must take concerted action to improve flood management, or as Vice Chairman Saman Simanjorang says, the city's growth is at stake.
If this isn't solved, we're worried that in the future the floods will go higher and will paralyse the city's economy.
When Jakarta stops, it affects the rest of the country. Around 60% of Indonesia's economic activity is linked to the capital. The floods prevented workers from reaching offices and factories or even their homes. It hindered access to industrial sites and the nation's biggest seaport. The city's business chamber estimates that around $155,000 was being lost every hour. And it warns if the problems aren't fixed, international investors will go elsewhere. Saman Simanjorang again.
Masalah banjir ini sudah merupakan satu tantangan yang sangat-sangat besar.
This flooding has become a major problem in Jakarta. This flood has caused the transportation chain to stop. The distribution is stopped, the logistics chain has been cut off, and trade transactions had to stop. This is what makes the business world worried.
The Public Works Ministry points out that compared to the floods in 2007, less people and property have been affected, and improvements have been made. But it's now speeding up measures to prevent future floods, including the construction of a spillway to divert floodwaters to another large underused canal. But wet and weary Jakartans wonder why the work wasn't done before, and the government doesn't really have an answer. Dr. Muhammad Hussain from the Public Works Ministry.
That's something that is one of the, you know, the weaknesses of human being. Whenever disaster comes, then they realize that that is because of our, you know, weaknesses in handling ecosystems.
For Jakarta's new governor, the flooding has put pressure on his recent election promises to fix the city. Joko Widodo says 100,000 infiltration wells to trap water and send it underground will be built. He'd already announced plans to dredge and widen rivers and move people to housing away from the riverbanks. The president, Susilo Bambang Yudhoyono, was shown in publicity shots wading about the palace grounds after agreeing to open them to flood overflow. It was the same week the president met the leaders of Argentina and Japan. And despite efforts to make it seem it was business as usual, the city's flashy, cosmopolitan image was taking a bath.
Kita sangat yakin bahwa sebenarnya pemerintah sangat-sangat mampu menanggulangi banjir ini.
We believe that the government is capable of mitigating the floods, but they never put their focus on that. If 5 years ago the government really did focus, this year's flood would never have happened.
But Marco Kusuma Wijaya can see a silver lining to this disaster. He says the government could learn from its mistakes and introduce long-term sustainable measures to prevent flooding, such as tackling deforestation and unchecked development. He says the key is to reduce the amount of surface runoff.
Because if the governments really change the approach to a sustainable and conservationist approach, I think we have the chance to be a pioneer among many other cities in developing countries.
And that was Helen Brown reporting from Indonesia. The United Nations is closer to setting up a commission of inquiry into North Korean crimes against humanity. Japan has confirmed its support, along with co-sponsors the European Union. The new inquiry will launch an in-depth investigation into human rights violations by the North Korean regime, both domestically and abroad. Human Rights Watch sent a letter on the issue to Prime Minister Shinzo Abe this month. The new commission of inquiry will be supported by a considerable budget and dedicated staff. Sen Lam speaks next to Kande Doi, the Japanese director of Human Rights Watch.
Human rights record of North Korea is egregious. It's one of the worst in the world, so it is very reasonable and right for the Japanese government to care about the situation. And then in addition to that, there are several Japanese nationals who are abducted by the North Korean government, which in fact the North Korean government has admitted. And also we know that a couple of hundreds of Japanese nationals claim that their loved ones might have been abducted by the North Korean government. So the Japanese government is interested in the situation of human rights abuses in North Korea, in particular situation of abducted Japanese.
Can you tell us more about the probe? Who will conduct it? What's its focus?
A new international inquiry is very important because although the human rights situation in North Korea has been abysmal and appalling for a long time, but the attention has been given not enough from the international community. So we would like to boost up the attention of the international community, and we would like to give voices. And in order to do so, currently we have a special rapporteur, one person who is looking into the situation, human rights situation in North Korea, but it's really not at all enough. We are proposing a commission of inquiry which would give a team to the special rapporteur who should be leading this investigation. And the commissioners would look into the human rights situation in North Korea as well as the rights abuses committed by North Korea outside of its territory, including abductees or the deprivation of food and so on.
What is the difference between this new inquiry and other inquiries that have taken place in the past? Is it because that this new UN inquiry will focus solely on North Korea and nothing else?
We have some commissions of inquiry established in the past. For example, there is one commission of inquiry into Syria working right now. And then in the past few years, we had, UN had established commission of inquiry on Libya, for example, Cote d'Ivoire, and so on. This commission of inquiry is understood as the most kind of important mechanism to, with authority, to look into grave human rights violations. What we want is a really in-depth investigation, which would give the comprehensive picture and of the situation, and then give voices to hundreds and thousands of victims of the violations by the North Korean government. In order to do so, we should have commissioners, perhaps, three people, and also a team to support these commissioners in order to give the full, picture to the world.
How meaningful do you think the exercise will be, even though it's supposed to be in-depth, if we can't, at the end of the day, if we can't get North Korea to shift or to cooperate?
Yeah, it can be still very meaningful if North Korea does not cooperate. Because we have a lot of escapees outside of North Korea already, and then so we can interview those, thousands of escapees, and then we can use some evidences such as satellite imageries and so on, and we can, of course, interview relatives of victims. So it is not necessary to go into North Korea. Have a very authoritative report talk about the facts, what's happening in North Korea, and then this report is going to recommend the international community, including the North Korean government, UN, and other governments, what steps they should take in order to address the situation.
Kenny Doi, the Japan Director of Human Rights Watch, speaking with Sen Lam. Google Maps has unveiled a detailed map of North Korea, filling in the blank spaces with information on streets, monuments, and as far as revealing some of its alleged prison camps. The new map was constructed by a group of citizen cartographers who worked for several years to collaborate on geographical information obtained by satellite imagery. The method, known as crowdsourcing, essentially the process of outsourcing a task to a non-professional public collective, pretty much like Wikipedia. To find out more, Jim Cochran contacted Jim McNamara, professor of public communications at UTS.
Well, a number of organizations are looking at crowdsourcing because, to be very frank, it's a much faster and cheaper way to do things, to produce an extensive set of maps of an entire peninsula with a team of experts would cost a lot of money, would probably take a lot of time. What they've done here is gone out and called for amateur cartographers, if you like, to voluntarily. So it's free labour, but an interesting sort of characteristic of the age we live in, the age of social media, is that there seems to be no shortage of people who want to voluntarily work on projects like this.
So let's look at what they actually did, because as I understand it, and please correct me if I'm wrong, but Google Earth provided the aerial view, the satellite images, and Google Map is the end result that people can view the map on. So in the middle, what exactly did the crowd do?
Well, cartographers actually produce the maps, so it's essentially a drawing exercise, and you're to do the drawings of the maps, plotting in roads, etc. You're relying on, and I'm not a cartographer, but what I'm told is you're relying on contour information and data from photographs. You're relying on visuals in those photographs, and you're combining that with other information. You know, there could be factual and statistical information on population densities, on facilities, on railroads, etc. So piecing together a lot of information using photographs, people draw maps.
And how is this project organized? Was it something that Google suggested?
Well, a number of organisations are doing this, and it's sort of increasingly happening where the organisation essentially goes out on the web and calls for volunteers to participate in a project. And this has actually happened with NASA as well. NASA's used amateur astronomers to help it identify and map craters on Mars, drawing on photographs. And the appeal, of course, is in the case of NASA, they used up to 80,000 people involved in a project. And it's a project that would have taken scientists probably years and years and years to do, and the whole thing was done in a matter of months. Very interestingly, and this is the big issue, is that American Scientist magazine looked at it and reported that the actual public effort was almost as accurate as the work done by, you know, planetary geologists in that case.
Which seems surprising when we're thinking of crowdsourcing in terms of a general public, but that's not really what we're dealing with here, is it? It's quite specifically skilled people who have either cartography or high-level scientific skills. In the case of this North Korea map, do we know who was the crowd? Where were they?
Well, we don't know specifically who they were, but one of the, as a general concept, one of the sort of changes that we're seeing with the era of Web 2 and social media is a challenge to the sort of older notion that the public are really the undereducated, you know, the punters, as marketers like to call them. In fact, the public, the community, is made up of a range of people, and there's a lot of experts out there. There are scientists, there are doctors, there are lawyers, there are a lot of highly educated people. And so with crowdsourcing, you're not necessarily allowing just anyone with no qualifications to get involved in a project. There usually is some filtering, but nevertheless, there is this fact that there are experts. The other issue with crowdsourcing that is changing the way we work is rather than relying on central editors or gatekeepers, as we call them, there's a self-correcting characteristic of the online world, where if somebody does post something that others believe is incorrect, others then come in and correct that. So you get this different way of editing, if you like, that's done collectively.
Now, the map came just weeks after Google boss Eric Schmidt visited North Korea. Do you imagine there might be some sort of connection between these two things?
Well, I suppose there is in Google's mind. I don't have access to that, but it does seem coincidental that he was there calling for more access. North Korea, of course, is a little bit of a black hole in terms of the internet. They do have an internal internet, but there's no penetration to the outside world internet for North Koreans other than maybe the elites in government. So I think Google, along with Facebook and a lot of other companies, would like to expand into those markets for their own reasons. But at the same time, the other risk in all this is that this may well stir up political tensions, because these maps are identifying, you know, not only roads and buildings, they're identifying nuclear power reactors and space facilities and even prison camps.
The experience of a large foreign investor in China could serve as a cautionary tale to other companies considering entering the Chinese market. The U.S. equipment giant Caterpillar has been forced to write down its latest investment by almost 90%. Caterpillar has sacked the senior management and has launched an investigation into its new acquisition. Karen Snowden has the details.
Caterpillar, the giant mining and construction equipment maker, has been operating in China for about 40 years. It's acquired 23 factories and 4 research and development centres in the country since 1978, employing 15,000 people. But all that experience didn't prevent it being the victim of what it's calling accounting misconduct. Having paid $650 million for the ERA mining machinery company, it's now written off $580 million of the value. Steve Vickers is CEO of Steve Vickers Associates, a specialist business risk firm in Hong Kong. He says warning signals included the reverse takeover of the listed ERA by the private company now causing the problem, Shiwei, and its claim of very high profits.
Well, 2020 hindsight is always a wonderful thing. However, this one does look a bit of a shocker. To be honest, I personally have dealt with half a dozen cases over the last couple of years involving Chinese firms that have been listed in either Hong Kong or the US. Through RTOs, reverse takeovers. And there are dangers implicitly in that. And also particularly those firms that show very apparently extraordinary growth in a very short period of time. I'm highly suspicious of those.
In a statement, Caterpillar says the problem lies with senior managers at Shiwei. It's investigating deliberate, coordinated accounting misconduct over several years, which overstated the company's earnings. The managers have been sacked and Caterpillar is considering its options, including litigation, to recover its losses. Steve Vickers says the sorry tale is a reminder of the importance of proper due diligence when investing in China.
There would appear to be clear evidence of deliberate overstating of revenues over a number of years. What this means is you cannot just rely on your accountants and lawyers to provide you with sufficient due diligence as you might in a Western country. You need to dig down much, much more deeply, use external resources to have a look in some depth at what's the reality, how they really operate, where the revenues really come from, rather than just accepting things on trust. But when it relates to emerging markets, particularly China, you need a far more top-down driven approach and a far more skeptical approach to deals.
And that's the lesson to be learned here?
Well, I can't. To be fair to Caterpillar, I think they are a fine firm with a very long, long history. I'm sure they'll get over this and move on. But clearly, this is a bit of a black eye for them.
Steve Vickers is the CEO of Steve Vickers Associates in Hong Kong. Caterpillar's written statement on the Shiwei fiasco includes its claim that its due diligence process for acquisitions is rigorous, robust, and includes Caterpillar personnel and outside accounting, legal, and financial advisors. This week, Caterpillar's executives reported its fourth quarter net income fell 55% to $697 million and said the problems at Shiwei are not expected to have a significant impact on profit and revenue in 2013.
And with that, we have come to the end of this edition of Focus Asia Pacific. If you wish to let us know what you think of the program, our email address is very simple. It's focus@pcjmedia.com. Once again, focus@pcjmedia.com. You can listen to this program again, as well as catch all past editions, by going to our website, www.pcjmedia.com/FAP. Once again, www.pcjmedia.com/FAP. So on behalf of the whole team, this is Keith Powell wishing you well. We'll see you in 7 days. Bye-bye, everyone.